Honourable members, we are back now. I think I must thank you for hanging on until we come back from the city. It took longer than we expected. We thought it would be very short, but the questions were very many to the president, and he had to go deep in answering them.
Can I have no problem, sir?
Yeah. Having said that, I am Jojo James. I'm chairing this panel, and I'm also the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Public Service and Administration. Can you please introduce yourself by telling us specifically about your background, experience, and why do you think you want this position you have applied for, of a commissioner for public service?
Thank you, Honorable. So my name is Zukiswa Mkolomba. I'm currently an executive. Currently now, according to the CV, the last on the CV is director, but I recently got appointed as an executive at the Competition Commission, which is an agency of the Department of Trade and Industry and Competition. At the level of a Deputy Director General at the Competition Commission. I'm a senior researcher, policy analyst, and program manager, and a political economist by training. I've got two master's degrees, a master's in public policy and administration, as well as a master's in poverty and development from the University of Sussex in the United Kingdom. So I'm very passionate about public service. I've been working for the public service for the past 10 years, and 5 of those years have been at a senior management level. So it is basically the DDG level where I'm currently at. And I've been doing research for a number of academics in the country, looking at the question of the developmental state and how to build a professionalized, capable public service that delivers on the promises of their mandates. And delivers quality services to the people at large. And the reason basically why I want to be a commissioner is that I believe that I'm a thinker. I'm a strong thinker. I'm a problem solver. And the fact that I'm young means that I bring new, innovative ideas to the running of the commission, as well as looking at problem solving around some of the challenges currently facing us as a society and facing public service in particular. So I believe that because I'm a thinker, I'm strategic in terms of nature, I have a broad overview of the challenges facing society, and I'm able to think strategically and in a practical manner looking at solutions on how to go about addressing those challenges. So I believe that I bring fresh energy to the commission, and I will be bringing innovative ideas and innovative solutions for how we can go about as a commission basically fulfilling a constitutional mandate as enshrined in Chapter 10 of the Constitution.
Okay. Can you... What is your understanding of the values and principles enshrined in Section 195 of the Constitution? You can give us a few and elaborate where you can.
No, I don't have a problem with that. So I read Section 195 and Section 196 of Chapter 10 of the Constitution as I obviously prepared for this particular interview. And I think the Bill of Rights are the founding rights that inform the rest of the values that are enshrined, the constitutional values and principles enshrined in Chapter 10. So when you look at the Bill of Rights of the Constitution, you find that our founding values of the Constitution is basically to make sure that we improve the quality of the lives of all South Africans and we exploit the potential of all citizens of South Africa. So issues of social justice, issues of equality, issues of respect, issues of human dignity, issues of freedom, issues of non-racialism, non-sexism, and democracy are basically the founding values of the Chapter 10 of the Constitution. In particular, when you look at the Public Service Commission and its mandate, and the constitutional values and principles enshrined in Chapter 10, the number one value that I like is the one that promotes a high level of professionalism and professional ethics in the public service, because that is what will determine how we deliver on our services to our people. Also, it's about being transparent, being fair, being equitable, being non-biased. So that's what the Public Commission is expected to be. It's about being client-orientated and responding to the needs of our clients or of the public, and also ensuring that the public participates in the policy-making processes of our country. Currently, the problem with participation is the fact that language continues to be a barrier. Our people don't often understand English, and often most of the time as government, you communicate in English, whereas there are 11 official languages in the country. So language becomes a barrier for participation, and the fact that the scheduling of our policy-making processes are taking place during the week, it means that people aren't able to take time off work to participate in the policy-making processes of our country. I also like the value that speaks to accountability and transparency, because Parliament has been elected by the people and government has been elected by the people. It's important that its officials are actually held accountable for fulfilling their particular mandates and fulfilling their obligations and tasks and responsibility as public servants. So I believe that we need to improve on the mechanisms of accountability in public service, as well as transparency, to make sure that information is readily available to the public to enable better decision-making on how they can employ and optimize and make use of the services provided by the public service. So those are just some of the examples of the constitutional values and principles of Chapter 10 of the Constitution that inform the work of the Commission, but most importantly, they are founded on the Bill of Rights. Issues of social justice, non-racialism, non-sexism, democracy, and respect.
Can you briefly tell us your understanding on the functions of the Public Service Commission? Briefly.
Oh, briefly. I was telling one of the colleagues who were interviewing that I had difficulty remembering. No, I will remember. Don't worry. I'll definitely try my best to remember. But the differentiation between vision, mission, function, and mandate. So I was just hoping that I was just trusting that I will obviously remember those, so I'm able to answer your questions succinctly. But you want to know about the mandate, ne? Okay. Oh, the functions. So in terms of the functions, the central point is about being a champion, not just being a champion, but driving constitutional values and ideals and democratic ideals in the country. And this is by conducting research, investigations, monitoring and evaluations on the operations, administration, and personnel practices in the public service. It's about reporting on the mandate that the Public Commission has and making sure that they are accountable to Parliament. It's about making sure that we are able to advise the public service on how they can improve departmental public service excellence and service delivery to the poor. It's about directing the laws, the principles, the policies, the practices regarding recruitment, transfers, dismissals, and labor relations in particular. So those are some of the functions that are the functions of the Public Service Commission, but the underlying value there is basically operating in such a way that you're able to drive constitutional and democratic ideals within the public service.
Thank you, Mama. The honorable members are going to ask you questions, but they will introduce themselves before they ask questions. I see you, Dr. Schreib.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good afternoon. Sorry once again for that long wait. My name is Dr. Leon Schreiber. I'm a member of this subcommittee and also the committee that is so ably chaired by my colleague there, Public Service and Administration. So just to jump straight into the question, so the Constitution provides for a very strong role for the Public Service Commission in upholding the principles of public administration. One of these functions is to give directions aimed at ensuring that personnel procedures relating to recruitment, transfers, promotions, and dismissals comply with the values and principles of public administration, as you've mentioned. What do you think is the best strategy moving forward to ensure that the PSC plays a bigger role in making sure that competent and dedicated people are appointed as public servants, particularly at senior management level?
Okay, so I think for me, there are two main strategic levers that the PSC can employ to make sure that they're able to deliver on that particular deliverable. And I think in terms of building a competent, professional, capable workforce that is committed to the constitutional and democratic values of our society and also committed to the public good, training and capacity building basically takes a primary role in ensuring that we build a competent and an experienced workforce. In regards to training, I think that one thing the PSC should be able to do is that, just like China, what the Chinese have done very well in building up the capacity within the public service is to take people with potential. They have entry examinations, firstly, that determine who gets into public service. And in terms of training and capacity building, they take potential public servants, especially young public servants, abroad for study abroad in education institutions in the UK, in the US, and other parts of Asia. So they do. So the partnership between higher education and public services is quite instrumental in driving capacity building within the public service. So I think that is something that South Africa, we could obviously emulate. If we had bursaries and scholarships to take our public servants abroad for studies and to make sure that they're exposed to high level and internationally benchmarked knowledge, that would be enable us to build capacity and capabilities within the public service. Secondly, I think if we could have secondments and fellowships for our fellowships for our public service, that would also be a good idea. Like in terms of building relationships with other governments across the country, in particular China, Indonesia, Singapore, Ghana, Kenya, and Brazil. These are countries that have been benchmarked as big, successful in democratic states. And if we can take our public servants and employ them to fellowships and secondments to other parts of the world and ensure that they are exposed to the workings of governments in other parts of the world, they will also build capacity within the public service. Thirdly, I like the compulsory program by the National School of Government that has been endorsed by Cabinet. And I think that if our public service were to participate in the programs of the National School of Government, they will also build capacity within the organization. And in particular, even through e-learning, not just face-to-face coursework, but through e-learning and job rotations as well. So I really believe that this internal capacity building and training, we're not meeting the international standards and we're not making use of the changes that lead towards building a knowledge society as we move towards the fourth industrial revolution. So I feel that we can actually modernize our training capabilities and ensure that the training needs of our public service are met by conducting skills audits that show the gaps within the public service and ensure that the PDMS, the tools we use for performance management, are actually used to build capacity and to fulfill the gaps of the public service.
Question? Okay.
Thank you, Chair. The question related specifically to the appointment process. So I hear what you're saying about training.
Okay.
But what do we do to make sure that when it comes to appointments, there's competent and dedicated people that are appointed in the first place?
Okay. So I think that we need to build institutional capacity that deals with the culture of patronage, nepotism, and corruption in the public service when it comes to appointments of senior level positions. And I think one thing we haven't capitalized on, the Public Service Commission hasn't advised the public service on how they can better deal with corruption, nepotism, and patronage. So my advice of sort of dealing with those types of incidences in the appointment of senior public servants is that we should actually have watchdogs within the departments that look out for transgressions and wrongdoing on the part of managers when it comes to appointments. There should be hotlines. There should be victim-friendly whistleblowing mechanisms. There should be training and certification. So if you build a culture of consequence management within the public service, where people know that if they are found to be in the wrong and doing wrong things, then there's going to be a consequence for that. That would ensure that the appointments at least are not based on patronage and connections and loyalties, but they actually are based on competence and meritocracy. And also, I think I like the idea that the National Development Plan has about having an administrative head that the DG appoints to, and not just reporting and accounting to the political heads and the political principals, which are the ministers. So if the DG would have an authority, like an administrative head, where he reports and basically shares his plans for he's going to build capacity and professionalize public service, and he will be reporting on the operational and administrative components of his duties, at least there will be dual reporting hybrid structures within the public service, and the tension that currently exists in terms of the political and administrative interface, that will be dealt with by having an administrative head. And that is something that hasn't been implemented currently by the current regime. But at least it's in the NDP, and it just needs to be implemented.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and good afternoon, Ms. Nkolomba.
Good afternoon, ma'am. It's evening now.
No, for us it's still good afternoon. So I'm sticking to the timetable in terms of the schedule.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I will comply.
Honourable, I cannot know because it's a morph and apology that.
Okay.
You still waited for us, but the energy and input to still have is much appreciated.
Thank you.
And the chair has apologized on our behalf. But having said that, Chair, one more from assumption that you read the advert, you read chapter 10 of the Constitution in terms of the Public Service Commission, specifically 195, but also you have gone through in a nutshell in terms of the NDP, as it were. So my question, Chair, through your good service, developmental state orientated question within that space.
Okay.
I'll make a preamble, then I'll then also ask you two questions as a background. The initial, the NDP made emphasis on that, now I'm quoting, that South Africa needs to build a state that is capable of playing a developmental and transformative role. Can you just take this committee in confidence? What are the challenges that hinder public administration in potentially realizing development of state?
Okay.
Second question, there were two I promised you. I keep my promise. What sort of public service is required by South Africa to achieve its developmental objectives? In a way, you might have partially just tried to get to that space, but I want you to be
present within that space. Thank you, Honourable Chair. The first question was about the
developmental
state, and... Chairperson. The first question was about the developmental state. I just wanted to understand the specifics of the question, but I definitely understand the second question.
Okay, can you
both questions are within the space of developmental state.
Yes.
Let me deal with the preamble of my question.
Okay.
The National Development Plan made an emphasis that South Africa needs to build a state that is capable of playing a developmental transformative role. The question then, I'll repeat both.
Okay.
What are the challenges that hinder, in your own view, by the way, hinder public administration in potentially realizing a developmental state? The second one now. What sort of public service is required by South Africa to achieve the developmental objectives. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and thank you, Honourable Member of Parliament. When it comes to the first question, looking at the challenges currently facing the public service, hindering its ability to become a developmental state, I think the first one is a matter of capacity within the state. I know that at least through, in terms of SMS appointments, at least the is competency-based, because at least all SMS have to go through competency-based assessments in order for them to actually make it to the successive rounds of interviews. And they also have to undergo a vetting process that ensures that at least the qualification verification, confidentiality verification, and secret confidentiality issues. But I think the fact that there's political interference currently as a consequence of a reckless system of care development, this is one thing that has hindered, in particular, local government from delivering on its mandate. Now, I don't see anything wrong with the care development policy per se, but I think if it's reckless and it's not based on competencies and based on skills and experience and a professional work ethic, then it becomes highly problematic. So political interference, in particular by political principles, becomes a number one challenge that this public service is currently facing. Secondly, I think there's an issue of capacity. So I mentioned capacity in terms of in my initial submission, that there's a capacity constraint when it comes to capacity building and training within the public service. So what we are trying to build is a competent, experienced, and a workforce that is committed to the ideals of the constitutional mandate and the values of the Constitution. So we have to improve on the training and capabilities building mechanisms within the public service, and to make sure that HR within public service plays a strategic role and not just an administrative role in the public service, to make sure that it is a strategic partner to the head of department and assisting him to build the capability and capacity of the public service through the correct appointments and also through training and development within the public service. Thirdly, there's a question of culture, the lazy culture that currently exists in some departments within the public service. It's not all departments. There are exceptional departments like your National Treasury and your DTI and Economic Development that has a culture of high work ethic within the organization, within the department. But there are also some departments, in particular municipalities, And local government, where there's a culture where public servants are not committed to delivering on their responsibilities and on the mandate of the department. Public servants come to work late, they leave early, they don't answer the phones when phones ring and clients are wanting information from them. They take long lunch breaks, they take long tea breaks. There's high levels of absenteeism. There's high levels of vacancy turnover rates. So those are issues, the culture issues, where our public servants aren't maintaining a high standard of professional work ethic, and that's something that needs to change and needs to be driven by the Public Service Commission in order to ensure that the public service becomes an employer of choice and is able to deliver on the mandate that is given to them by the people. In terms of the second question, what type of public service servants, what type of public administration do we need to ensure that we reach our developmental objectives? So basically workforce, your human resource and your workforce basically is the number one priority, because it is the instrument and the tool that you use to deliver according to the mandate, to deliver to the promises given to the people. So if you don't build and transform the workforce, then you're going to have a fundamental problem of delivering on the mandate of the public service. So I really believe that we should strive to build a workforce that is professional, competent, experienced, committed to the values of the Constitution and the values of our democracy, committed to delivering high levels of services to our people, and basically committed to the public good. And that's the vision that I have for public service. And I think that the Public Service Commission will play an instrumental role on advising on how we build capacity within the public service and how we transform the attitudes and the culture and the ethos within the public service as a whole.
Just a follow-up, Honourable Chair. you, Ms. Colombo, agree with me that probably all what you have said, summary, is poor management and a will to manage? So I want just to confirm that one, Chair, because also there is an existing department and managers and everybody, and also the role of the EA.
So I think it's two things. You can't divorce management from political interference, because currently our heads of departments are only accountable to political principals who have their own interests that aren't always aligned to the interests of a transformed and effective and capable public service. So I know that in terms of your heads of department, there's a high turnover rate. I think it's about 70-90% within the public service currently. And it means that your heads of departments are frustrated because of the political interference and the political culture of bullying and victimization within the public service by political principles. And so the high turnover rate is a problem. And so again, the question is, why are heads of departments leaving public service? Why are they not honoring the contracts of 5 to 10 years? Why aren't they building and actually keeping with the mandate? So you can't divorce management from the question of political interference. But secondly, I do think that it's not even a matter of management. It's about leadership and having the political will to basically drive an effective state that delivers on the promises of its people. So management plays a critical component, but remember the difference between leadership and management. Management is just the first basic competencies that and it can be measured, and it's currently being measured by the service providers who provide psychometric tests when assessing the management expertise of our managers. But leadership, you can't learn leadership. Leadership is basically having the political will to drive change within an organization. It's got to do with an attitude and an inward vision and mission that you have for your organization. So I believe that management matters, but leadership matters even more. And most importantly, making sure that the interface between the political and administrative is basically addressed. So that then that's why you would have two reporting lines, one to the administrative head and one to the political principal, to make sure that the tensions that exist between the political principal and the HOD in regards to political interference are effectively dealt with.
Thank you, Madam Colomba. I wish to check, as we are interviewing you now, personally, if you will be given a chance to be a public service commissioner, how are you going to deal with the separation of these two, administrative and political interference? Thank you.
So I think as a commissioner, we need to begin, we've been given a mission to be non-biased, equitable, respectful, and fair, and to be independent, independently minded. And I think it's important, it's actually about high time that commissioners take a harder stance on the questions of political interference, in particular when it comes to issues of cadership deployment by some of the parties that are ruling, are governing at the moment. So the commissioner needs to have difficult conversations with the political elite, which is basically the president of the ruling party, as in particular the secretary general of the ruling party, and as well as opposition parties, both even opposition parties currently in the municipalities where they rule. They also have the policy of cadre deployment, even though they do deny it. So it's about having tough conversations with the political elite and explaining to them what are the consequences of political interference and the non-separation between the political and the administration and how it's negatively affecting the performance of the public service. I think maybe also having workshops, campaigns, and training programs for politicians as well as heads of department, so that maybe even the compulsory program on ethics by the National School of Government, that could assist in teaching our political principles on what to do and on the things that they're allowed to do and things that they're not allowed to do when it comes to public service administration. So I think a campaign program that engages a multi variety of stakeholders, in particular the political elite, is an important angle to use to make sure that we engage properly on questions of ethics and how political interference is basically damaging the performance of the public service.
Honorable Chair, welcome and good evening, Ms. Mkolomba.
Good evening, Honorable.
I'm Miriam Gibbs, a member of the committee and also a member of this panel. I'm going to ask you a question on good governance. Effective governance in the public sector encourages better decision making and the efficient use of resources. Now my first question is, how would you define good governance, when Ms. Mkolomba? And my second one would be, what are the 5 main principles of good governance within the context of a democratic government and efficient public service? Thank you.
So I think for me, good governance primarily has to do with the effective and efficient use of resources, allocation of resources, use of resources, as well as accounting for how you use those resources. So primarily it's about, the question is, you've been given resources by the public. And as a government, how are you using the taxpayers' money? Are we able to see impact in terms of the use of those resources? But most importantly, it's about the utilization, the best utilization and allocation of resources as given to you by the public. And that's how I would define good governance. And in terms of the principles that define good governance, I think it's about fairness. Firstly, prioritization and fairness. So how do you prioritize when you allocate your budget to different units within your department, to different programs within your department, and in the different facets of service delivery within your department? So it's about allocation, prioritization, as well as fairness. Are you fair? Are you non-biased? Do you discriminate? Do you only give priority budget only to the things that you deem important as a minister or as a DG, or do you consider that the minority groups who are benefactors of a public service, do you consider their needs? So are you fair in the allocation of the budget? And most importantly for me, it's about another principle is about impact. Are you being impactful in how you use the public purse when it's been allocated to you? What are the indicators of impact? How do you measure impact? Do you even measure impact? And what is the impact of the budgets in driving the programs of your department? So it's fairness, it's prioritization, it's good allocation, it's impact, and it's measuring it. So that's how, those are the principles I would consider to be important when it comes to good governance implementation within a public service.
Thank you, Chair. Now, the issue of corruption is obviously front and center in the public service, and one of the ways in which it really continues to manifest is in the case of public servants doing business with the state. So, Chair, we know that there's already legal mechanisms in place to prevent this, and yet this practice is continuing. So, what would you say, in your view, is the best way to make sure that a law which is on the books is actually implemented, and what is the PSC's role in preventing public servants from doing business with the state? Thanks.
So I think one thing we've not done well in public service is this notion of a cooling off period, enforcing a notion of a cooling off period in the contracts of public service. It's one thing to tell public servants not to do business with government. But it's another thing also, the issue of afterwards, is there a cooling off period that they're supposed to take to make sure that they don't exploit the relationships that were formed whilst they were in public service. But also, so basically, when I was going through the documentation of the Public Service Commission, I noticed that there's actually no document that speaks to how public service can deal effectively with corruption on an everyday practical way. Yes, we've got policies that speak to procurement policies, that speak to what to do when you are appointing and how you should, the processes that should be followed. But there's a lack of a culture of consequence management within the public service. And that is why we're not doing well in dealing with corruption as well as dealing with patronage and nepotism within the public service. And some of the ideas that I have regarding dealing with corruption, it literally is about building institutional capacity in the public service to deal effectively with corruption by building a culture of consequence management and building institutions that basically are in charge of investigating, monitoring, and advising on prosecution when it comes to consequence management within the public service. If we don't have a hotline or a call center that people can call to complain and to expose people in the public service, if we don't have whistleblowing policies that protect victims who report wrongdoers and transgressors within the public service, there's no watchdog that actually literally overlooks and investigates when complaints have been received in public service. So I think that we don't have the institutional capability at the moment because we're not being innovative as a commission in advising public service on how they can go about dealing with questions of corruption. But the key answer is consequence management, building a culture of consequence management by building the institutions in not just policies, but building institutional mechanisms within to deal with people who transgress procurement policies.
Thank you, Chair. I just want, for the sake of clarity, you say that there is no watchdog over the public service, but isn't that the job of the Public Service Commission?
So that's the trick, right? So I was reading when I was preparing for this interview. I know that the Public Service Commission advises and has oversight, but it's really the constitutional mandate has to do with oversight and advising. There's no mandate to implement, no mandate to basically deal with appeals, no mandate to basically set norms and standards, no mandate to recruit. The implementation tools of the commission has actually been limited by virtue of the limitations in the constitutional mandate. So what I would advise is that there needs to be a review on the mandate, and we need to make sure that we put policies in place, and there should be a review of the constitution so that at least from an implementation angle, the commission is able to do its job by building institutional capabilities on behalf of the public service. So I think it's a question of reviewing the constitutional mandate and extending the mandate of the Public Service Commission to ensure that it's got the bite and not just the teeth, but the bite to ensure that it achieves its mandate broadly within transforming public service.
Miss Golomba. Golomba, no, I need to pronounce it correctly.
No, you've done a good job, Member of Parliament, Honourable Member.
Thank you, ma'am. If I may, Chair, if you go to Chapter 10 of the Constitution in relation to public service, as it were, and you go further to Section 196.5, it talks about the Public Service Commission to be expected to report in National Assembly at least once a year.
Mm.
So that's one. Mm. But two, also, there's a question that was raised by Honorable Sibisi in terms of the political interface and the administration, and you responded to that. I'm just making a statement so that you don't lose sight on that. But my follow-up question, Chair, in terms of also within the public service regulations eliminating corruption, what is your view in terms of this perception that the senior public service management, they're not so keen to be vetted? What's your view on that within the issue of dealing with corruption? Thank you, Chair.
So vetting is important. So we do qualification vetting. We do criminal record vetting. We do financial vetting in terms of your credit record. especially if you're going to be a manager over millions and billions of worth of resources. So vetting is an important component of ensuring that we appoint people who are credible, the right people within the public service. But obviously, if your credit record is not good and you want to be chief financial officer, you're not going to want to be vetted because it's not in your interest, because you'll be exposed as a leader and therefore possibly not appointed as a senior manager. But I think that, so despite what heads of departments feel about vetting, vetting plays an instrumental role in ensuring that the right people and people of talent, people of character, people of integrity are appointed in the public service, because it's not just about qualifications and experience, but also about character, personality, attitude. So vetting plays an instrumental role in ensuring that the right people are appointed. So despite the views and the interests of heads of departments, I would recommend that it becomes enforced. It needs to be a mandatory component of the recruitment processes of public service, despite what the views of the head of department are. It needs to be mandatory, no doubt.
Yeah, Mr. Mkolomba, I am Mzwakhe Sibisi, also a member of this portfolio committee. In your presentation, you talk about that one of commissioners' mandate is to strengthen oversight. So I wish to invite you and take you on oversight.
Okay, thank you.
How do you think the Public Service Commissioner, one, can strengthen its own oversight? Two, oversight by Parliament.
So I think an important component of oversight is the question of reporting. So reporting plays an instrumental role, it's investigating, monitoring, and evaluating whether or not public service is complying to the mandate of the Public Service Administration as enshrined in the Constitution. So there's a component of assessments, assessing whether or not there's compliance to the Constitution. And then there's a question of making sure that we consult widely with stakeholders who make use of the services of the public service. So if you don't consult and you don't conduct surveys, you won't have a clue of whether or not you're meeting the needs of the people at large and the public in South Africa. Then there's a question of reporting. I think there needs to be quarterly reports that lead up to an annual report. So you don't just wait for one moment where you're reporting to Parliament as a public service commission, but you actually conduct quarterly reports so you ask the DG to prepare quarterly reports to the chairperson of the Public Service Commission, and then the quarterly reports will eventually lead to an annual report that covers comprehensively the work of the Public Service Commission and how it's gone about trying to basically transform and to build a capable professional public service for South Africa. So that's what I think about how we can strengthen its own oversight. And also, most importantly, I think when it comes to Parliament, I think the Public Service Commission needs to be impartial, non-biased, fair, equitable, and making sure that it's not scared to raise the difficult questions that people are currently grappling with in the public service. It's about making sure that it conducts an honest appraisal and reports honestly to Parliament on the work it's been doing, both the strengths as well as the weaknesses, the missed opportunities and the threats that currently face the Commission. And it's about making sure that it reports with integrity. Otherwise, Parliament also needs to play its own part. The Public Service Commission doesn't have a role towards strengthening Parliament. The strengthening of Parliament is the responsibility of members of Parliament, but it has a responsibility for honest, factual, evidence-based reporting and making sure that it explains to Parliament fully on the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats that it's experienced over the past year when reporting annually.
I'm still on the floor. On your presentation again, you mentioned something about the NDP. So I will take you now to the state national address of the president, which has outlined seven priorities for the sixth administration. among is to build capable, ethical and developmental state, which is what Chapter 10 of the Constitution envisages. So can you tell us what role should the PSC play in ensuring realization of building capable, ethical and developmental state?
So as I said in my initial submission, the vision literally is about building a professional, competent, experienced workforce or public servants who are committed to the constitutional ideals and the democratic ideals of the country, as well as committed to delivering high levels of service to the poor and to the public at large, and devoted to the public good. So that's basically the vision when I interpret the Constitution, to the tenor of the Constitution, as well as the NDP envisions. It means that the state needs to be transformative, participatory, and it needs to be effective and capable, basically, in ensuring it delivers delivers the mandate that has been given by the people. So the role that the Public Service Commission can play, I think research, number one. There needs to be extensive research studies in partnership with PARI, which is Public Affairs Research Institute, as well as other higher education institutions, looking at not just the work being done in the public service, but looking at the impact of the programs of government in making sure that we deal with issues of poverty, unemployment, joblessness, economic growth within our country. Basically, a developmental state, in essence, is a state that basically makes sure that it drives economic growth, job creation, industrialization, and trade in the country. It's not a society that is dependent on the market mechanism. So there's a view amongst neoliberal politicians that the state interferes. When the state interferes with the market, it is basically disruptive and it's got a negative consequence in society. But our vision of building a developmental state and understands the state being central in transforming society and making sure that we achieve high levels of growth and job creation and poverty alleviation in the country. So we can play a better role in conducting research, making sure that we understand not just what the public service is doing, but also understand the impact that the programs of public service are having on the vulnerable and the poorest of the poor within the organization. Secondly, the question of ensuring that the values enshrined in the Constitution, the values enshrined in the Batupele principles, the democratic ideals are embodied in the life and in the people that are serving in the public service. So how do we do that? By electing and appointing values champions within the public service to ensure that the stakeholder buy-in and employee buy-in of the constitutional values enshrined in the Constitution. It means that incentivizing for an alignment between performance plans and the performance outcomes of employees in as far as constitutional values and principles are concerned. So it means that we have to measure whether or not our public servants are meeting the criteria and the requirements of the constitutional values and principles. And most importantly, making sure that we incentivize employers to conform and to basically adopt the constitutional values as their own. So using the contract as a tool and using a performance management tool as well as contracts as a tool for enforcing the change in the culture of the public service and so that it's more aligned with our constitutional values. So those are some of the examples that I have in mind when it comes to how the Public Service Commission can actually improve the awareness and the familiarity and the embodiment of public service ethos within the public service. Thank you.
Good evening, Mr. Colombo. My name is Makoni Duli, member of this panel, and also member of the panel. My question is around the disclosure on finances. If I can give you the background, the financial disclosure framework is aimed at preventing conflicts of interest by requiring members of the management service to disclose their financial interests. Then the question is, provide an explanation on how the financial disclosure works.
So, ma'am, I've been in public service for 10 years, and 5 of which have been at senior management level. So I've been exposed to the financial disclosure system by the public service. So basically, it's an online process by which annually public servants have to, senior members of management have to actually go on and they disclose all their financial interests, whether it comes to property, land ownership, owning businesses, and stuff like that. But they have to disclose basically their assets to government. And then government after that, once there's disclosure, if there's non-disclosure, government actually does a random verification process whereby they investigate whether or not what has been disclosed is the accurate information that is supposed to be disclosed. And if people haven't disclosed their business interests, then there's a consequence management process by which perhaps there will be a DC that will be held, where possibly you will be suspended and even dismissed as an SMS member for not disclosing your financial interests. So it's an online process. It has a verification process by, I think, I'm assuming it's state security that does the verification, but in working together with human resources, and they verify whether or not the interests are accurately disclosed. And if there's non-disclosure, then they undergo a process where you have to account for the non-disclosure. And if it's proven that you've been dishonest, then there's a disciplinary hearing in the public service, whereby you can even be fined, suspended, or even dismissed as a member of the senior SMS. So that's how I understand the financial disclosure system. And I think it's a good system because really, if there are conflicts of interest within the public service, this will basically be detrimental to service delivery outcomes in the public service. So the financial disclosure process is a necessary evil, even though it's cumbersome sometimes and it's quite administrative and most employees don't like to do it, it's a necessary evil to make sure that there are no conflicts of interest and that we're able to deliver on our mandate and the promises of our people with good conscience.
My second question is on the power to appoint. The first question will come in two folds, and then the standalone question. Let me give you the background. The power to appoint in South Africa is assigned by Section 3, Article 7 of the Public Service Act. Ministers or MECs can delegate the power to officials within the department. The question is, what are the major obstacles in the recruitment system in the public sector? That is the first part. The second part of this question is the public sector recruitment system effective in order to ensure professional and capable state? Then the last standalone question is, what can be the role of the Public Service Commission in eliminating unethical practices in the recruitment system in order to ensure public servants are appointed based on merit?
So currently, the EA has the powers to appoint, and the EA, the executive authority in this regard, is the minister. So it's the political principal, as you said also in the statement that in your introductory remarks. The problem with that is the fact that if you don't have delineation between the political and the administrative when it comes to the interface, you're going to have a situation where political interference and patronage basically determines who gets appointed in senior positions, as opposed to merit, experience, expertise, and professionalism within the service. And that's why, for me, I really believe that ministers should delegate the responsibility of appointing to heads of department, which are your director generals. And then obviously the Director General will be the accounting officer, and he will give the responsibility of appointing to basically HR and the divisional managers, your directors. Usually directors are the ones who appoint for the unit, for their subunits, and they would have chief directors and DDGs depending on which level you are appointing in the public service. So I would really support a situation of delegation where heads of state are accountable for appointments within their departments, because they're the ones who are driving department performance. They're the ones responsible for department performance and excellence within their departments. And the HR should play a strategic role as a strategic partner to the accounting officer, as opposed to just playing a simple administrative role. I think HR in public service is limited. They're not thinking strategically in terms of how they can ensure that you build the capabilities and the capacities of the departments, and in partnership with dialogue with the DG. So I think HR can play a more strategic role in doing so. In terms of whether or not our recruitment system is effective, I think when it comes to SMS, I like the fact that there are compulsory competency tests that have to be taken in order for appointments to be done. So that's very good, and it's basically similar to what the Chinese are doing when it comes to entry examinations that determine who gets into public service. So our SMS process to the competency assessments, you can determine who gets appointed in senior management positions. But the question is, to what extent are those competency assessment reports utilized by the appointing officers, whether it be a director or a chief director or a DG? So that is what is questionable, is that we're not sure to what extent HR can enforce for those competency assessments to be the determining factors in who is gets recruited in public service. So I do think that for SMS recruitment, we're doing a good job, but for appointments of junior members of the public service, there are no assessments. So I would recommend that at the very least, when it comes to junior level appointments and recruitments, there should be technical exercises done together with interviews that determine whether or not someone gets appointed into the public service. Because at least with the exercises, the technical exercises, you can actually role play and determine at least to what extent this person might be able to perform in a given role that he or she is applying for. So I think that's a challenge. And in fact, and I also mentioned political interference, the fact that, and also even interference on the part of the DG, administrative interference, that should be addressed. And that's basically a weakness with our current regime, is that political interference, in particular at municipality level, is actually hampering the ability of HR and the administrative heads to appoint suitable members into public service. And then the role that the Public Service Commission can play in getting rid of unethical practices. I've already spoken in detail about this, and this is the building culture of consequence management within the public service, wherein transgressors who appoint public servants who are not qualified for their jobs are actually held accountable for doing so. So not just building a culture of consequence management, but building institutional capacity within the public service to deal with transgressors through a form of DCs, and then enforcing suspensions and dismissals within the public service. So that's what I would recommend the public service does, is to basically put together a strategy document that will assist public service managers to deal with corruption. The question is, how do you build a culture of consequence management, and most importantly, which institutional capabilities should you introduce in your departments to make sure that you deal with transgressors effectively? So there needs to be an advice and a strategy document developed by the Commission to help public servants deal with corruption effectively.
Thank you.
Is there any question you would like to put to the committee or comment you want to make? If no question you have.
So So I think when I know that when I applied for this particular role, so I've got experience in the public service. I've got the passion for it. I've done research on building and transforming public service in the country and doing benchmark exercises with China. So I know that in terms of capabilities and competence and passion and motivation and drive, this is what I wanted to do, and I could possibly do fulfill this role effectively. But then the question of my age came up in my mind, and I was like, what are the chances of Parliament appointing a 34-year-old to be a commissioner? But then I also realized that actually there was even a person who was younger than me, who was 28, who was interviewed by Parliament. So I just wanted to appreciate the fact that at least now I'm confident that I won't be discriminated against on the basis of my age, but that I will be assessed on the basis of my competence levels and my abilities to fulfill this particular role. And I think that is something for me which is commendable. So this is a comment that I wanted to make to members of Parliament. And the question that I do have, though, was a question around, so there are 14 commissioners in total, 9 in the provinces and 5 in national office. Well, how is the division of roles in the execution of the mandate of the Public Service Commission divided between the 5 commissioners? Or do they have specific portfolios that they are responsible for?
Honorable Wu?
But it's got nothing to do with the age.
Yes.
What did Chair think I must respond to? No, but having said that, that I'll respond in twofold. One is that there are 5 national and 9, but as a collective, they become the Public Service Commission.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do then, in terms of areas of focus and governance, let me say governance,
mm-hmm.
they distribute among themselves.
Okay.
Other ones deal with social, economic issues, others financial management, human resource, and so forth.
Okay.
So then that's how they are.
Mm.
But also the other one is that probably I thought we were going to raise with this question is that currently then you cannot assess a commissioner as an individual.
Mm.
You assess them as a collective.
Mm.
But also then it does have an impact in terms of renewability and non-renewability and so forth. But in short, they work as a collective.
Okay.
And also they assess as a collective.
Okay, no, thank you very much. It's very clear. Thank you, member, honorable member.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the very difficult questions.
Ms. Mkolomba, thank you very much. You will be informed of the results of this interview. You understand that we have many applicants that we must interview.
Mm-hmm.
At the conclusion of the interview, each applicant will be informed of the result.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much once again.
Thank you very much, Jefferson.
You are released.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Going to crucify you, but we are going to ask questions in order to be sure that you are the right candidate for the position you have applied for. if you feel like drinking water during questioning, you are allowed to do that. The questions in the interview will be more practical than theoretical, but we would expect you to balance practice with theory in answering them. Having said that, I will be the first to ask question. I am Giorgio James, the chair of this panel, also the chairperson of the Public Service and Administration Portfolio Committee in Parliament. Can you introduce yourself by telling us about your background and experience, and why do you want to be a public commissioner, a public service commissioner, so to speak? The floor is yours.
Thank you, Chairperson. My background, I've got more than 30 years in government service, public service, and I've been working in various departments and also parastatals. And I've been, throughout that, I've been assigned to more executive position than what I'm supposed to be doing. Where I'm working now, I'm at the peak of my career, but the executive now and then, they assign me the acting positions in various acting positions in chief director. One is monitoring and evaluation. The other one was the corporate support services, and the other one was land tenure. And the recent one was in cooperatives. And throughout those positions through your chair, I've gathered a lot of skills, and one of them, two or three, I'll mention in terms of human leadership and also in terms of how you deal with the labor relations and issues, and also in terms to deal, engage with the service delivery project, because all those years I've been doing a project in my life and I know how best to do it. And the other issue, I'm an expert in monitoring and evaluation, and I'm also a seasoned researcher. Hence, recently I was also appointed by the Minister of Agriculture to be part of the one of the council which advised him because of my research. And the other thing, why do I want to, or in terms of, I'm also talking more about the experience. So I think in the terms of experience, that's all. But I can also add that in terms of the background, in terms of my qualification, apart from internationally recognized PhD, I also done the Master's in Business Administration. I also been nominated by the Department of Trade and Industry to be trained in corporate governance. And then why do I want to be a public service commissioner? I've looked at the advert recently, and what I've seen, the requirement, I think they were written all over me. One was the public, you have to be a citizen. My status in my ID is I'm a citizen of South Africa. And the other issue which I've seen, which is in terms of the person who's got a knowledge and experience in administration, and also a person who is got an experience in terms of provision of public services. And that is also been backed up by my 30 years experience in public service commission. And for me, when I look at that position, I realize this is my position, this is what I have to, hence I even apply for that.
The Public Service Commission has a constitutional mandate to promote the values and principles of Section 195. What is your understanding of the values and principles that are enshrined in Section 195 of the Constitution? You can mention few or elaborate well if you feel elaborating.
Thanks, Chen, through you. What I understand in terms of Constitution values and principles in Section 195 is that they determine the existence of the public service, and the other issue which is very crucial is in terms of the stakeholders. It also assists in terms of the stakeholders on what the service they want. And if you look at these constitutional value principles through your chair, we can't discuss them without also talking issues like the founding principles in the section one, which are in terms of human dignity, the non-racialism and narcissism, and also supremacy of law. I think we must also, when we discuss this constitutional value principles, and I'll mention them, and it's also to note for the House that it's not necessarily most of them are complementary and they are related. And these are the first one, which I also like, is in terms of professional ethics. And the second one, I think it's more on using the public resources in a manner, in efficient, effective and efficient way. And the other thing is that the public service which we aspire should be development orientated. And the other one is in terms of accountability. And the other one is transparency. And the other one, I think that it's transparency, accountability, and also in terms of good human resource management. And the last one, if not last, I think it's we have to develop public service which is representative of all South Africans. And I've said, Chair, when I in the opening when I was discussing this constitutional value principles, that they are complementary and sometimes they are related to each other. You can't talk about the development orientated and where I'm sitting, because I've been dealing with a lot of projects, without also looking at the transparency. And again, Chair, you can't talk about issues on the other one, which is, I think, in terms of also the transparency, you can't talk that without also looking in terms of how you use your resources, which are very limited in the government as a whole now, in terms of effective, efficient, and economical. So those are some of the values I've mentioned through your chair. I don't know whether I've missed something, but that's how I understand them. And you can't just discuss them without also looking at the founding principles which are found in Section 1, which I've already alluded to.
What is your understanding of the functions of the Public Service Commission?
Thank you very much. I think what I understand is not something which I'm just going to say it from my own understanding. It's something which is within the Constitution, Section 196, where they also mention in terms of the powers, I think it's item 4. And one of the most important is to promote the constitutional value principles. And the second one is 4E, which is very crucial. Why I'll say that, I'll elaborate. It's in terms of reporting all activities. It's also mentioned in the Act, in the Constitution, that we, as a commissioner, we have to report to the Parliament at a national level, and those who are sitting at the provincial level, they'll do that at the legislature on an annual basis. So I think basically that's the most important function of the commissioner, to promote the constitutional value and also to do the reporting in terms of tracking all the activities, to check whether the compliance thereof of the constitutional value principles.
The members of the panel are going to ask you, but each member will introduce him or herself to you. Then I'm handing over to Honorable Schreiber.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good evening, Dr. Monyai. Sorry that it took so long. My name is Dr. Leon Schreiber. I'm a member of this subcommittee and on the Portfolio Committee on Public Service and Administration. One of the key functions of the Public Service Commission is that it actually has a strong role in upholding the principles of public administration. One of these principles and functions is to give directions aimed at ensuring that personnel procedures surrounding recruitment, transfers, promotions, and dismissals comply with the values of public and principles of public administration. What would you say is the best strategy for the Public Service Commission to actually make sure that this happens in reality, to make sure that there are competent and proper and dedicated people appointed, particularly at senior management level? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think as a public service, we have to adhere also to Public Service Act, which also outlines in terms of appointment, transfer, dismissal. And if you wanted to get the competent people, for Public Service Commission, it's going to be very difficult because I've gone through the reports of Public Service Commission, and I've seen a lot of issues, which I'm not saying I'm going to fix them now, but it's still there on the doorstep of the Portfolio Committee. One of them is that the recommendation of Public Service Commission is not taken seriously. And I also know that with my own experience, if you want, I can share with you. And the other issue now in terms of Public Service Commission, I think there's a perception outside there. People doesn't understand. They doesn't know about it. They took it as a part of the department, although it is constitutionally mandated. So, and also the recommendations are not legal binding. Why I'm saying that it was, in as much as you can do all the departments, we're also going to sit with a lot of grievances in terms of there was a promotion, I was marginalized, but it all boils down as Public Service Commission to try to look at the leaders. By the leaders, I'm referring to the executive authority, although we don't have much time with them, but also the head of departments to sit with them. Because we are dealing as a Public Service Commission in one, all the levels of the government, the second, the organ of the state, and also the public enterprises. So we have to sit with them. Because it's simple. They can do that recruitment without even coming to Public Service Commission. And we were there, it's one of our mandates to try to come out with a good human resource. But how do we do that? We are over, because also there's a BPCA in between. But at the end of the day, I think what we have to do through your chair, we have to create awareness, our existence. Why Public Service Commission? I think through that, the rest will be straight. Because we also had some systems and processes. Hence, we are good governance. And already, there's a porosity because we are not adhering for that. Not that we are not doing a lot. I think the Public Service Commission is doing so much now. Well, sitting. Thanks.
Chair, and good evening, Ms. Monyai, and Doctor. But she's still a miss, ne?
Yeah.
Those are the qualifications to be a doctor. No, but those are the qualifications we acquired. No, I'm saying that because also we shouldn't lose our identity as well.
Mm.
Because the borrowed one then sort of mislead us sometimes.
Mm.
But on a lighter note, ma'am. But let me appreciate you, because when we arrived here in the morning, honestly, you were here. And I thought you were going to the other committee, and now I know that you're waiting for us patiently. But probably talks in our admin logistics as well. Notwithstanding that, we had a sitting today as well. But I think the chair has amplified in a more elaborate way to apologize on our behalf on that. Because when the president speaks, all of us must be there. And it's very important to show that respect. But
noted, preach.
It's from my heart, not even from my brain. Having said that, Chair, Ms. Monyai, Dr. Monyai, if I may, but also I'm tempted to ask a follow-up question, Chair. you are saying that in terms of the EAs and the heads of department engagement, but also you say that the Act doesn't specifically say in terms of that, but also you are aware, because I know, and also you are going to confirm me that you have gone through the Act in terms of section 196, in particular 195, in particular 196, that speaks to you, the Public Service Commission, in terms of reporting to Parliament. But also the way you are saying it, it seems like there's a gap. As a person that is strong in research, and also specifics, which part of the Act that doesn't give the Public Service Commission the chief, so to speak, to be taken seriously? Because there's this also the interface with the portfolio committee. This one, it's a follow-up from this one. My principal question, then let me come to it, Chair. My principal question will be around developmental state. I'll do a preamble and then two questions, which are sub of the preamble of developmental state. This national development plan, which we assume that you have read it, made an emphasis that South Africa needs to build a state that is capable of playing a developmental role and a transformative role. Okay? Then the question, there are two. What are the challenges that hinder public administration in potentially realizing the developmental state? Then the second one, what sort of public service you believe that we require in South Africa to achieve its developmental objectives? So you get it that I made a reference to NDP. I don't want to read it because I need to be very consistent in terms of my question to go to other countries. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, through Chair. I think it's indeed, I noted the National Development Plan 2030, which also stated in terms of capable developmental state. Also, the Public Administration Management Act also echoed that. So I think there are two issues there. And also the outcome approach, outcome 12, which is also binding. It also talks about the efficient, effective, orientated government. So in a nutshell, what you said in terms of developmental state, the problem here is in terms of this is one of the constitutional value principle. We really wanted to do something, but we really don't know why the things are. And one of the things is the budget constraints. And when you look at that developmental state, I think we're almost there. It's almost 20 years, two decades, and now five. But the thing is, there are some issues which we really need to talk and put it through. And in terms of Public Service Commission, you are very much right, Chair, that there are some gaps in terms of and how best can we do that. Because PAC is one, it's recommended. It's a constitutionally a mandate. And it's only one public service in the government. And as I've already indicated, people are not even aware about us. Sorry, I'm not yet with you. They're not aware about this Public Service Commission. They also took it as a department. And also in terms of, there's not so much we can do because we are more like the public protector. But their recommendations, they are not binding. And in as much as we wanted to do something, I think I've seen when I go through your website, there are very brilliant plans, program of action, but how do we implement that? There's a problem. And that problem is not something which you can do overnight. It's something which you have to change the mindset. And I'm very happy when I look at the work done by Public Service Commission. I was so excited because they already started with the roadshow, even the constitutional value principles, where I'm sitting as an expert in monitoring evaluation. I'm so excited because now they're coming with the dimension. They're also coming with the indicators. How best can we measure that? So basically, I think more work is done in terms of that, and also in terms of also aligning with the NDP, as you said, and also Public Administrative Management Act, which also put into action the National School of Governance, which is also going to train the human resource. really, a lot of things are happening. It's just that the pace we're doing it, and I can't blame it to anyone. It's a team, it's a collective thing. So you can't come now and say you are going to change everything, because it's constitutionally mandated, but we have to sit down. I think we are the right forum to look at it and see how best we can advise you if I happen to be one of the commissioners. And I've done a lot of research, and I'm a researcher on my own, and I'm very excited and passionate when I work with. And when I look at it, it's not things are not happening. Things are already there. And as I already said, we are a custodian of good governance. And we're not seeing that because the porosity in terms of service delivery process, all those issues. Recently we got East Dimini. Recently we heard about the people who were turned down from Northwest, the patients. What does it talk? It says something in our good custodian governance, as a good governance, something is wrong. But it's not that big, but you can still make it and collectively, because I can't come here and mem and change everything through your chair. Collectively, we have to study and come with strategy and how best, and with our plan, short, it should be short, medium, and at a long term, what is it, what we're going to do. Because there's nothing we can do. PSC is there. it's already there on the constitution. You can't change that. So the only thing is us, how best can we put our plans in action so that we can be seen as a developmental state. Because we also had other people helping us, like National School of Garden. I don't want to repeat that. And the other thing you said, the PSC, if I can just ask to PSC, the last one, through the chair, the last question, there were two questions, but the other one says in terms of the objectives, I still remember just Jordan PSC's objectives.
I know sometimes I, for this tendency, I'm told yes, always, but I think sometimes I speak fast.
That is fine.
When I'm comfortable with the subject matter.
Okay.
What sort of public service is required by SA South Africa to achieve its developmental objectives?
Okay.
Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thank you very much. I think what we have to do, as we are, the Public Service Commission, as it is, there's no organ of state. No public enterprise, no three levels of the government can interfere with this work. So what actually have to work in terms of the Public Service Commission, I think basically it's more on how best can we promote this constitutional value principles, which I think the PC is way ahead in what they are doing in terms of promoting that. And the other thing, I'm from the Department of Rural Development. Last year, through your chair, they came, I think it was in September, in the executive meeting, as I indicated, I'm always acting chief director, and they were doing the presentation. And I couldn't believe the people were not aware, at the executive level, they were not aware about this Public Service Commission. It was a something new, and people were asking questions, and we were so excited because we don't know what is happening. People, we got employees, as I said, people will have what we get agreed, they write to us, and then we take them to labor relations, and nothing is happening. On their own, they send it to the Public Service Commission, and within 30 days, if it is level 1 to 12, we'll receive something. Within 45 days, in terms of your delivery, we'll get that. But the problem is the department, the head of department or the executive authority, they don't even implement or recommend. And we always have these problems. So I think the only thing we have to do now is in terms, because all the plans, as they already said for us, it's just to be aggressive in the approach how to implement it so that we can have a developmental state and then we can be proud that we're a custodian of a good governance.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Ms. Monyai, I am Miriam Kibi, a member of the panel and also a member of the committee. Ms. Munyai, my question will be based on good governance. in effective governance in the public sector encourages better decision making and the efficient use of resources. Now my question is, how would you define good governance? That is my first question. And my second one is, what are the five main principles of good governance within the context of a democratic government and efficient public service? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ruchin. I think in terms of good governance, all those principles, constitution value principles, which are spelled out in 195, they are all aimed to for us to come up with the, to promote this good governance. But let me just explain to it. In terms when you say good governance, it entails also some rules and laws which have to be put in place. And also, when you say good governance, if I'm just passing here, I'll tell you is the decision making, and that decision making, and also the implementation thereof. Decision making and the implementation thereof. And that is decision making, as I indicated, it will be come up through the rules and laws which are on the table, which we are also mandated. And the other thing in terms of good governance, the corporate governance, it says there must be four principles. One of them is fairness, responsibility, and also the transparency. Those are the main issues in terms of the good governance. And as Public Service Commission, it's also been entrusted to come with its services in terms of efficiency. As you mentioned, that when we use that, it should be a fair and also equitable and also non-biased and also impartial. So those are the main issues whenever we sit down and talk about the good governance. But the most important principles is that fairness, responsibility, and also the transparency. So that's why if we do our things, it should be transparent. We have to be fair and impartial, and nothing should even affect, no one will interfere with our work and shouldn't be biased. I think those basically are the good governance, but it's just a decision making and the implementation thereof based on the rules and processes which are on the table.
Thank you,
Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Corruption is one of the perennial issues in the public service, and one of the specific ways in which it manifests is when public servants do business with the state. Now, as you know, there is already a law in place, legal provisions against this, and yet the practice does continue. What would be your advice or opinion on the role of the Public Service Commission, or more broadly, to make sure that this specific example of corruption, public servants doing business with the state, is actually addressed and implemented?
Thank you very much. I think that's a topic which is all over the country now in South Africa. We see what is happening with the state capture. I'm not saying it aloud. So those are some of the things which are happening. So in terms of corruption, corruption is something which it involves a lot of things, fraud, bribery. So for us to do that, when I go through the Public Service Commission, and also know as an executive from where I'm working, that you already have the national hotline, corruption hotline. And it's not simple to eradicate that corruption. We can go all out and try to do that. And I'm very happy because I've seen also your report in terms of corruption. I think, Chair, through you, the most important thing is when you hire people, more especially at the executive and the HOD. I'm not so certain whether you do the induction courses, because that's where we can have the grip. If you are going to head the department, these are the issues in terms of corruption. Because they'll just, you know, it's so frustrating. Because sometimes I even see the Public Service Commission, all the departments, they have to report to them in terms of the cases of misconduct. And they're not getting any because they don't. They just see this another institution sitting somewhere. So we have to have this aggressive approach because if, I mean, the fish are caught in the head. So if you can just grasp this leadership and then sit with them and tell them these are the issues and this is how you can and also enforce the management consequences so that they know. Because whatever you do, they will still have to do a lot of corruption, really. But if you can just mobilize the people in the forefront, the leadership, I think it can just creep down and the people will start. We are not going to root it within a day that it can't be done. But if you can look back, I think there's a major stride from the Department of Public Service Commission. But the thing is, we don't have much of a support from the various departments and all those organs of state and public enterprise which report. It's so bad outside there. But it can't be bad like that. We are trying. I think the best thing has already, as in terms of the development state, capable state, we also have to come out and see how best can we do. But I don't know, but if I happen to get this position, I think I'll also have to look at the national hotline, national corruption hotline. What is it? How best can we improve on that? But, Chair, the corruption is so, I don't know. It's all over, and that's the thing which we have to fight with. And that's the thing which makes us, as a Public Service Commission, as a custodian of governance, people are starting to worry that there's something. So we have to try to close, because we can't be proud of saying we are the custodian of good governance while there's still a lot of corruption out there. But it's a joint, it's a multidisciplinary approach. We need also the portfolio committee to assist us. We can go out as a commission, but we have also to need an ear from the portfolio committee. How best can you advise us and moving forward?
Yes, Chair. I just want to zoom in then on, you spoke about corruption generally now, but specifically on public servants doing business with the state. How do we tackle that specific issue?
Thank you, Chair. That issue is mostly done at a senior management level because those are the people who have to do the disclosure. So far, I read some of the articles, I mean some of the reports, which are saying senior managers are not even reporting, are not disclosing. And you find one manager having more than you go to, usually they give us the report. I've got also a luxury to look at this report. Who's got so many companies and they never declare them. And those companies, sometimes, they use their friends, they use their families, they use Miss TV there, and then you don't find that. But at the end of the day, you find their directors. But the government service, the e-disclosure, it's very simple. Go and declare. And I don't know why they're not declaring. Which means now, it goes back through your chair, that the leadership, because this SMS, they're the leadership. So let's sit down with them and try to, because it's worse now to the 12 gone down. They won't even declare. They are doing business. Sometimes you find people, it's like they are just coming to work just to clock that you are there and then they move in. You see, there's something somewhere there. But you've got a very good system and which we said people must declare every financial year. But you don't go with that. So that one we're not going to keep it. Because why should it wait as a senior manager, knowing very well that what I'm doing is not right? I'm still doing business with the government. And I knew it has been said now and then that you shouldn't do that. But you still find my ID and I'm sitting as a director or not even a director. You know, there's a whole lot of things, but it goes down in the system of disclosure. So I think as a public service commission, we should also try and sit and see how best can we improve on that system, because the systems are there. It's almost like the system of performance management system. Mm-hmm. It's there, but I see now the Public Service Commission is struggling. How best can they come out with something? Because now it's another question. But I'm just giving an example, as you said, also because I'm working there. You find this in terms of implementation, it's almost like that you're doing business. A senior manager sits the whole year. He's not even assisting his or her own team. But at the end of the day, sometimes they just, I've seen that, they just call the people the same day they are writing, giving their scores. What's the use of that system? Something is wrong. And sometimes it's because this person is the favoritism. It's my friend or my girlfriend. So we just give them those. And sometimes we disadvantage. I know that, and through experience. Those who are very smart, who are supposed to get that bonuses in terms of bonuses, they don't get it. Somebody's sitting, who comes 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock, they're gone. They get it. So we are also demoralizing. And as per this service commission, one of the constitutional value is that in terms of good human resource management, I think we have to look at that. Because we are having so much problems and unnecessary because we've got the systems. I think here, through each chair, one is also to look in terms of that, how best can we improve on that, so that everyone is accountable, including their leaders. And I think basically that's how to do. We're not come with something else. It's either we overhaul it or we look at the system, how best is it trying to assist us. Thanks.
As a follow-up from Doctor's question to Doctor as well, is the view, what is your view in terms of declaration of financial interest in terms of the subject matter that the Doctor has raised, honorable member? Because it seems like there's a perception that says that people are not keen in terms of, in particular, senior management level, they're not keen in terms of vetting. So what is your view on that? Should it be mandatory, or is it worth it or what? Thank you, Chair.
Thanks. I've been in the government service, and I think I started to be at the management level way back, I think 1998. I've been there before Democratic. I understand both sides. When it comes to vetting, man, you know, a person can decline a job just to say you are going to be vetted. They've got a lot of skeletons. And even when you interview me, like sitting here, I can say a lot of things. And then you ask me, Dr. Munyai, give us all your skeleton. I said, I don't have. Knowing very well. And possibly the person who's going to hire me said, ah, man, let's just leave that thing. It started there. So in terms of vetting also, because there are two issues now, vetting, also the vetting, it takes long. I also have been subjected to it. I'm telling most of my colleagues, sometimes there was a roadshow, people will be telling so many things that I don't want to go there. I'm not dealing with monies. Why should I go there? They come with a lot of excuses. And if you go back, most of the departments, their senior managers are not vetted. And that's why there's a problem. And you ask yourself, they'll tell you, I'm not part of the money. And in PFMA, it says very clearly that every public servant must use its the limited resources efficiently, effectively, and economically. Already you are using money. You can't say you are not part of it, because any budget, whatever you do, key performance area, it's money interested there. So I think basically this vetting issue already is there, but how best can we do it? I personally, I think it's mandatory, but people choose not to do it. And how do we enforce that compliance? And sometimes, as PSCC way sitting, it can recommend that. And I understand and I know that your recommendations, our recommendations, are not enforceable. So how best can you do that? But sometimes, because we don't, I like PSC the way they operate, because they're not a rule-driven or authority, because if you go with authority, we'll distract everything. So I think we should have to be seen with our constitution that these are the things, give it to the relevant department, and when they give it to us, let's sit around the table. These are the issues in terms of vetting. These are the consequences if you don't have people who are vetted. And also, it goes down when they do the recruitment. So I think if we can come with a lot of things, but it's not, people doesn't want to be subjected to that. I know very well they don't want. So basically, they refuse to do the declaration, they refuse to do the vetting, and because they know who in that particular department, they won't do it. Because they know who in that particular public enterprises, they won't do it. Because they know who in those three spheres of the government, they won't do it. Those who doesn't know who, they will eventually go and do that so that they can have their own, they can keep their job.
Dr. Miyai, good evening. I'm Honorable Sibisi. You have said a lot, but now what is left, you want to assess your oversight. How do you think the PSC can strengthen its own oversight and oversight by Parliament?
Thank you very much, Drucha. I think the PSC were sitting at a good position because we report to the Parliament, and whoever who doesn't even want to do whatever we wanted or our recommendation, we can subpoena them. We are sitting at that, but the only thing is that is whatever our recommendation, they are not legal binding. So in as much we got truth, but our truth are not, they can't have a firm grip. That's one. And also in terms of oversight by Parliament, I think basically that's it. I don't want to make so many a narrative.
I'm still on the floor. Let's move to another question. During the State of Nation Address, President outlined 7 priorities for the sixth administration. Among is to build capable, ethical, and developmental state, which is what Chapter 10 of the Constitution envisages. Therefore, what role should the PSC play in ensuring realization of building capable, ethical, and developmental state?
Thank you very much. I think the president, where he was sitting from, he was also, I think he's also the author of our National Development Plan and author of our Constitution. So I think we must take him so seriously because he understands what he's doing. And when we deal with such a person, that we have to be very, very, very careful. And also I mentioned the issue of Public Management Act, which is also an administrative act, which is also enforcing that development state. So what basically can we do? I think our president, if I can just go quickly back, he also said, in terms of that, what do we do? He also reconfigured the departments. And he mentioned 4 crucial issues. One was in terms of cost containment. The second one was the cooperative governance. The other thing was a strategic alliance. And if you look at those, he was trying to reconfigure. Where I'm coming from, I'm at the rural development. Now we are going to be one department with agriculture for in terms of the cost containment. That's very important. And now when we do that development state, capable development state, you can't be capable when we don't have financing. We need a lot of money, and we don't have, this whole government doesn't have, I don't know where it could be sitting, we don't have, we've got a limited budget. So what do we do in terms of that limited budget? The services we render out should be in terms of effective, efficient, and also economical. In terms of efficient, we have to do more with less that we get. And in terms of effective, it has to do in terms of the outcome versus the objectives which you have put down. And in terms of economical, it's when we have to procure some services. So basically, and we avoid wastage. So this is an overarching. So wherever we're sitting, we have to look at those 3 E's, economical, efficient, and also effective, so that we can also deliver more. There are some departments, through your chair, which we've seen. They will say, chair, or president, whoever they reported to, we have done well. We got clean, we got unqualified audit. And then you sit down and you watch. What does this mean? You find they haven't even reached their target. So that thing doesn't balance. So we still have some, it's not a capable state, because we're not trying to finish what we wanted to do. And it's not because of funds. They've finished everything, but they haven't done anything. And by the way, what we're doing, we've got a public upside there. We need our services in terms of sanitation, in terms of electricity, in terms of all those things, in terms of health, as I've already indicated, there were people who were turned down in Northwest. This is the many cases, this case that's captured with what? So all those things, how best can we do that? It comes with us. And it's not something which it's going to be, it's something which is also legislated with the Public Finance Management Act. So once we do that, we must also enforce that people should look at this Public Financial Management Act. And it's very simple. Somewhere 30, Section 38, where there are four issues, where also in terms of the asset, you also have to generate a revenue. Those are some of the things which an ordinary official has to do. So basically where we are sitting, even the budget, I don't think Public Service Commission is sitting with the budget. I think somewhere possible we can, but those are some of the things, if I happen to get that position, to look what is it, what we can do so that our state looks developmental, even the people, because people are not happy. People are not happy as we are sitting here. They have got a lot of things, and you can't satisfy them, but at least we can do something for them. Okay, just to meet them halfway, although it won't be halfway. But with all these structures, as I indicated, the action of plan I've seen in the Public Service Commission, I think somewhere we can do that, and then possible we can sit as a team of commissioners, including the executive or PSC. I think there will be chairperson and the DG, and we sit down and possibly come out with a way forward. But you can imagine, it started almost 20 years, two decades. Now we're on the 25th. So it's not something which will have to happen overnight. It's something which we can decide, all of us, and see how best can we do it. Because that's where we have to. And the president already indicated that that's how things should be done. Thanks.
Doc, as you are invited to be part of interviewee, what we want from you, I hope you have read chapter 10, section 195, which speaks of values, principles. But now, after all that we have said, what is happening that is not good, that is bad. But what we want from you, Doc, is the how part. What would be the solution to all these problems you are mentioning? Because we want you to tell us, how are you going to manage and give us a solution? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think basically, if you are given a problem to solve, firstly, you have to do a lot of research. Firstly, you have to understand what is it, what is happening. You have to understand how the public service work. And you also, as I said, it's not like nothing is happening in the Public Service Commission. So if I happen to get this position, the first thing I have to do, I think those are long-hanging fruits, and I think it's to look at the reports, look at those gaps, and how best can we do it, not alone, as a team. I always like working as a team. Possible in terms of decision, I can do it on my own and come out with the strategies in terms of short term, long term, and medium and long term. What is it, what I'm going to do, long hanging fruits, possible within 30 days, because I think you need a person who will hit the ground running. I hear what you're saying. But from where I'm sitting now, I'm just looking at those challenges. Sometimes they could be peripheral. They are not really a problem. For example, people are saying ESCOM. ESCOM is because they don't have a budget, they're poor planning. It's not like that. We have to do research. You find that there's a whole lot of issues before this budget. So basically, because also the Public Service Commission, I like Public Service Commission because there are issues which are constitutionally there. So there's not so much changes we have to do. We sit as a team, get all the gaps. Already where I'm sitting now, I understand most of these gaps. How best can we move forward? As I said, it's not something which we have done overnight. It's a decade. It's almost 2 decades now moving forward. And then the legal abdu possible after this interview, I'll just preempt it. You will tell me if you happen to have this position, these are the law hanging fruits. These are the quick things we wanted you to do within 30 days or 40 days, which I will do that. I'll comply with that. I hear what you're saying.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good evening, Dr. Young. The financial disclosure framework is aimed at preventing conflicts of interest, but requiring members of the senior management service to disclose their financial interest. Now, the question is, provide an explanation on how the financial disclosure works, having given you the big.
Through Chair, what you are saying is that how does the financial disclosure, the process? Okay, thank you very much. I think the process of financial, the financial disclosure in each department, right at the beginning of each year, is within each financial year, you are required to disclose what are your financial interests and what are, in terms of what in terms of businesses or what you are doing, and also some of us are in the director's board. What is it, and then you have to declare that, and there's a time frame. I think it's first of April to the end of April, you should have done that. And I'm so happy, I'm not talking about my department, we have to always comply 100% in terms of that.
We'll check that.
But we do that. So I think there's a time frame, each and every year. And through your chair, there are this HR means every day you see an ICM, an internal message for all the employees to do that. But still, things fall under cracks. I don't know. I think that's where we said possible that system and also the leadership and try to conscientize them in doing that. That's basically what is happening in terms of how.
Another question is, may I give you the background? The power to appoint in South Africa is assigned by Section 3, the 7 of the Public Service Act. Ministers or MECs can delegate the power to officials within the department. Now, my question, for three questions. The first one comes into twofold, and for the last one, that is the second one. First one is, what are the major obstacles in the recruitment system in the public sector? That is the first part. Then the second part is the public sector recruitment system effective in order to ensure professional and capable state? Then the last question, which is a standalone. If you want me to repeat, I can do so, but through the chairperson. The last question, which is a standalone, is what can be the role of the PSC in eliminating unethical practices in the recruitment system in order to ensure public servants are appointed based on merit?
Thank you very much. I think the first one, in terms of the major obstacles in terms of recruitment, I think I share, because basically, it's not a matter of recruiting. It's a matter of you've got a legal binding document in each organization, which is an organizational structure. So basically, you must have that organizational structure in the table. And then you have to check whom do you want to appoint in that particular. And then you have to come with the requirement and the responsibilities. Those are the things there. As the chair said, there must also terms of experience and mixed theory and practical. Those are theoretical issues. But for the past 30 years when I'm in the Public Service Commission, you find those requirements and responsibilities are there in line with what we wanted to do and also with the strategic plan. But the strategic plan can change on a 5-yearly basis, but the organizational structure is there. You find there are sometimes a serious omission because I wanted to hire my cousin and my cousin can't qualify for that. And then we override that. And you find many people are marginalized. I know that for a fact. And I think also Public Service Commission is sitting with such problems because people are not adhering. They even sometimes they said for a senior manager position, you have to have 5 years. But you find that I've got a friend who's got a 4 years. I said, no, it's fine. You are qualified. And you find sometimes we need a degree. And we can't just say degree. Many times we'll spell it. I've been the cooperative chief director. We said we need a BCom or somebody who's been in the finance business. Mark my words, Trishan. You'll find a person who's done anthropology and biblical studies. Not that they're not the courses, but they're irrelevant. But that person is going to be appointed. And why are we doing that? It jeopardizes service delivery. Because that particular person will never do anything. They don't do anything. They have defense mechanism. They will fight with the team. Because the team, they've got the youngsters, the deputy directors, whoever, who are highly qualified. And they don't even understand what you're trying to do. But at the end of the day, you have to comply. That's how public service it is. You just, because it's a senior manager, there's something you can't do. So that's how porous this system is. The system is there. And then really, what I've seen, when they send an advert, I think they are so scared somebody will see it, that this is not a really, but they usually put a right advert. And also when they put that, the skills audit, many departments haven't done skills audit now. They are mismatched with what we wanted to do. But if you understand in an organization, what is it what we wanted to do? We need a certain person, and we stick to that. And then we do that. But I think mostly what we can do, I was also having this issue that it's not that Public Service Commission can sit all this, but it can in terms of the leadership positions. We can also send people there to be our representative and see whether the recruitment is transparent. Because it's not now, Chair. It's not at all. I think most of the problems in the Public Service Commission are because of this. People are marginalized, but they've got a structure. You go there, and all the cases I know from our department, they've got a serious recommendation that you have done wrong, but they're not going to implement it. So that's one in terms of the recruitment. I think we need the competency and what we are going to do because we are sitting with the public money and we have to come out with the public service, provision of public service. But if you are not qualified and you don't even understand what is happening, there's a big problem. And the other thing is that, public sector effective. So by getting people who got the wrong skills in the public service, you are also having a serious problem. We've heard about things. Let me just say this on the public domain. Pardon me for saying that one person was an executive and doesn't even have a metric. I'm sorry to say that happened, but we override it because of our other issues. So there's no service delivery there. And there was a board, another CEO. I'm so interested on these things, who was appointed, and she was a CEO. She was the chair of the board. I'm not going to mention a name, but the CEO was expelled, dismissed, and she volunteered to be a CEO, the chair, and then she volunteered to be a CEO. So you can see, those are some of the why should you do that. because the CEO, they report to the board get the mandate from the relevant department. So somewhere, but when you look at it, they said she has been in that position without a proper qualification. It's because of whom do I know? So one of the constitutional value principles of the PSC is in terms of good human resource management, in terms of also tracking, in terms of recruitment, dismissal. I think basically where we are, we do have a mechanism to do that. But it's, as I'm saying, it's very difficult. You write the recommendation to the minister. The minister's chair, they're always busy. They won't even see that recommendation. And I, as a deputy director general of corporate services, who has done that harm, that letter will come to me. And I will run to the minister and say, I received that letter, but I'll do this and this and this. And the minister, they will say, yes, do that. And that particular case won't have any way to go. You just get under. And people are demoralized. I know even from my own. People are demoralized. It's so scary up there. So, Public Service Commission has got a teeth to bite, but how best can we do it? Because you do this, but it doesn't even have to reach at the Public Service Commission. It should have been dealt there. That's why I always keep on saying, possible, we go back, we induct these leaders, more especially this head of departments, and their executive, the DDGs and whoever, that this is the way we have to do things. But I don't know. We have to come with a mechanism, because I've seen the report recently now, which was served in this portfolio committee. That report is saying they've done 153 recommendations and only 45, which means it's almost 30%. They've got a response. And what about other? And can you imagine, we also work with limited resources. The people who have done that, to make one case, they usually say it's not more than, let's put it as an SMS, 45 days. Can you imagine those people at Public Service Commission, how much work they've done to come with that, but nothing is done. And until when that situation is going to be like that? Because it's also, and we can't enforce them to do it, because that's not our mandate. We always try to call them. But some of them, mark my words, I've seen that they don't even respond. They don't even know that somebody has sent a report, because this Public Service Commission is like that, another department. It's not constitutional mandate. But if things comes from public protector, you can see how they run. But the same thing. So something has to be done. And I'm not saying things are not done properly here. They are done properly. So we have to be aggressive in trying to get the mechanism to enforce that. Thanks.
I thank
you. It's just a brief one, Chair. The issue of political involvement in appointments, do you think that that is something, whether it's termed cater deployment or whatever you want to call it, is that something which is ethical and appropriate? Or do you think it should be abolished and instead a body like the Public Service Commission or someone else should have a much stronger role at the expense of politicians making appointment decisions or influencing those decisions? Thanks.
Thank you. This issue of ethical, colleagues, the way the governments are run now is like military. People are so scared. They won't say anything. I'm sitting here, I'm a living example of that. And I'm one of the best. I'm not recommending myself. And I'm like that. You go to the interview, you satisfy all the requirements. And the minister in the evening says, oh, hold on. I've got mischievous son. She must get the job. No one will say a word. The very same people who even reported, I'm a living example, I can even show you. Those people who said, you are the best, we're going to interview you, they changed. They changed the requirements to meet that particular person. And those things, it's only when they've done it for somebody who's bold enough can take them to labor relations, wait for 30 minutes, 30 days, and then you take it to Public Service Commission. And can you see that you are marginalized? Your life is terrible now because you are not one of them. What does it do? It goes to Public Service Commission. Public Service Commission, we use all those limited resources. We try to go all over because it's not something we got already processes of grievance procedure, disciplinary code. We have those processes. And they said, okay, there was something which was done incorrectly for this person, reinstated or reimbursed. It won't even come back. The minister won't even see that letter. That person will die with stress, depressed, even run mad or run away from the department. They even go and get attorneys. I've seen that, and I knew about that. So it's not easy to add. It's easy to see that thing, but it's not easy to talk about it. Who are you now? The head of departments, they're also looking at their back. They can't fight, although he's an accountable person, but he can't. Knowing very well that Dr. Mia must get this position. But he doesn't because he also doesn't know his contract of being a DG is expiring in 2 months' time. So if he can't do that, he won't even get renewal. So that is rife. And how best can we get it? Possible through you, Chair. Because few will send that, but few won't even do that. Again, it's a matter of things that it's something. I mean, and the executive authority, those are politicians. They don't do the running of the department. We have seen now a lot of cases here where the DGs, they said they must go back because they were not supposed to be dismissed by the minister. They are reinstated because the processes are there. But who are you? Can you imagine a level 13 going to public to check why I was there? They even now do what they are doing. It's so interesting. Through your chair, they even change the delegation. I know from my own experience, the DG is not supposed to hire the chief director. They change it overnight and they assign it. So that, because these departments, they've gotten the political head who's got the deputy ministers. And the deputy ministers, they won't even talk the same language. So it won't go there. So he or she appoint. Where will you go? Will you say, no, the job description was like that. They've already changed it last week with the DDG, CSF. Who also wanted to be seen as a nice person. I personally, I felt we must also sell these things. If I happen to be in the PSC, that when we do the roadshow, we talk to them. These are the situation, and we're not gonna leave it like that. We're going to follow it up. But sometimes it can, and then they said the minister are not there. But sometimes they just need one of their cousins to get a job. So it's still rife, and something should be done, and it's so painful. Thank you.
Dr. Mia, is there any question you want to put to the committee or comment to make?
Firstly, it's a comment. I think the portfolio committee, you put exactly what type of person you want in this position. If you were a person who did even not understand what Public Service Commission is, and you didn't even answer a question, by the time you move out, you will understand what they wanted to do. The other issue is that I'm also very excited and looking forward to work with you and the way you were posing the questions. They were not difficult, but there were questions where you wanted to probe more, to find out what is happening. And at the time, I was also becoming emotional, talking about my own experience, because it's related to this. And the last thing which I wanted to know, through your chair, is in terms of what do you want if the incumbent of this position to do within 30 or 60 days?
No, I think, you know, you would have responded, but also touched the wood. You know, Doc, I think earlier on you did allude to that there are 5 national commissioners and 9. In total, which makes it 14, they work as a collective. So even when the assessment, if you go to the Act as well, in terms of the responsibility of Public Service Commission, it talks about renewability and non-renewability. But also there's no guidance in terms of the format and the non-subjective of advising from the Portfolio Committee point of view to advise the President whether Dr. Monyai should be renewed or non-renewed his her contract. So those are the things. But also when they work, execute their work, they work as a commission of 15 men, good men and women. So they don't, we don't see them and separate them as individuals, hence then the individualistic approach and expectation doesn't exist. However, then they allocate in terms of the areas of focus, in terms of the compliance and good corporate governance and what the Act expects them. For an example, you will be, if you are fortunate enough, for an example, be allocated on HR space, on economic space, on financial space, on compliance space. So that's what it happens. You tend to be also be clustered in terms of the areas, but also they take to account within among yourselves account of your strong points and so forth. So from this side of the Portfolio Committee, when you engage with us, we engage with us as a collective, but also then a specific area. Let's say we're dealing with a financial disclosure. So a person that is responsible in terms of the financial management, PFMA compliance, supply chain management, oversight as it were in terms of the Public Service Commission, then will come to the Portfolio Committee and represent the collective, not the individual. Thank you, Chair.
Let me thank you very much, Dr. Munyai. You will be informed in writing about the results of this interview, because we still have to interview more. There are many applicants. So at the end of this whole process, each applicant will be informed in writing of the results of the interview. Thank you very much. You are released.
Thank you.